Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to welcome back to the microphones Jason Fischbach, Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties. You know, Jason and I usually get a chance to talk in May when I'm in Bayfield for the Bayfield and Bloom Festival there, and always have a great time, and I'm really pleased to have him with us today to talk about what's going on in the garden, maybe extending that season as long as possible, and certainly taking the questions that you have for him. And you can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, email us at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and maybe you've got a good garden picture. Post that as well. We'd love to see that too. Jason Fischbach with us by phone. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Larry. Good morning. It's good to be on the phone.
It's great to be with you, to have you with us today. I really appreciate it. I'm going to start out with my own question for you. I have some tomatoes, heirloom tomatoes called Mr. Stripey. They are very large right now and look beautiful, except they are green, and they do not seem to want to be turning red. Now, is there any way I can make them turn red?
Well, if you want to leave them on the vine, which I think is your best bet at this point, my crystal ball says the frost won't be here for two more weeks, maybe more. So the thing to do is to try to give it the best opportunity you can for it to ripen. And so that means keeping the slugs off of it. That means keeping good airflow around that tomato. And that means pruning. You know, at this point, we've got all the tomatoes that are going to be set for the year. And so we want to protect those best we can. And if your tomato patch looks like mine, it's 5 or 10 plants flopped out on the ground growing everywhere. So get the scissors out and get in there and start pruning off all those leaves that have the septoria or the early blight. Cut off all the growing points. We don't need any new vegetation. Mm-hmm. And you might even trim it down to just a handful of those clusters and tomatoes and put get the sun on those. And you know, this time of year we especially start getting these heavy dews.
Yep.
And it dries out real slowly in the morning, and that's what the slugs love, and that's what the fungal diseases love. So it shouldn't look like much more than a skeleton plant with you know, maybe a dozen good healthy leaves on it, and that's it.
That is great.
We get into the frost season here. You know, some floating rubber can help protect it from frost. You get another couple of weeks, perhaps, to ripen those things.
You are a magician. Thank you so much. I'm going to take your suggestions to heart, for sure. And I know there are other people out there with that same question.
It's hard to do. Those tomato plants look gorgeous. Time to give them a haircut.
Okay. Ruth and Ladysmith has a question for you. Ruth, hi.
Hi. I'm just wondering, is it safe now to trim oak trees? I have a small oak in the front yard that the branches are kind of low, and I want to mow underneath.
Yeah, right. Typically for our woody perennial species, we don't want to do any fall pruning, because what can happen is it can trigger some new growth, and that growth then can be sensitive to these cold, to the frosts. And you're better off pruning these trees now once they go dormant, once they drop their leaves. And you can do that pretty much any time December through March. It's usually better on the other side of the calendar, so January, February. But I know it's kind of annoying. You get hit in the head when you're mowing, but just hold off for a couple of months.
And probably the oak wilt issue is almost past, but you never know.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be more inclined to wait just for the worry of that.
Yeah, but it's so awkward to get out a chainsaw in the middle of winter.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do it. I know that.
Well, I tell you what, Ruth, you get somebody out there to do it for you then.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks a lot for calling. Cheryl in Madison. On to you now. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi there. I have a question. I have some well-established asparagus plants that I want to move from one garden to another. What would be the best way to approach that in time of year?
I would wait as long as you can this fall.
Okay.
And, you know, before the ground freezes, if you could give yourself 3 or 4 weeks, so let's say the end of October,
December,
maybe even into October, and then
okay.
You should see the flower stalks starting to dry down, and you can trim those off and then transplant your asparagus. Then you might want to mulch them just to keep that soil warmer a little bit later to help get the new roots going.
Okay. And how long do you think it will take for them to reestablish in the new location?
It depends how big that crown is, but if it's a big, vigorous crown that you transplant, you should have plenty of asparagus next year.
Okay.
If you see kind of weak spears coming out, not a lot of them, I wouldn't pick any. But if it looks pretty robust and you're seeing some good growth, then feel free to pick some of them anyway.
Okay, and then one other question. The area I'm transplanting them into is pretty acidic. Is there any issues with that? They're moving from more of a loamy soil to something that seems a lot more acidic, actually, because it's surrounded by pine trees.
Mm-hmm. The only good way to know is to test that soil, and with asparagus, you just don't want to be something extreme, right? Somewhere in the sixes is fine. And your best bet might just be to amend it with some nice compost.
Compost. Okay, great. All right, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for calling. And Karen and Nina, we turn to you. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
This morning, with the storms that came through, Nina, our sugar maple in the front yard just cracked wide open, and we're going to have to replace it. I've had a little bit of a concern, though, because I've noticed that there's been a few other maples in the neighborhood that appear to have been dying from verticillium wilt. So I don't know if I should replace it with another maple, which I, because I just love my maple. But is there a way to test the soil to see if we have that in there?
Yeah, you can. You can take option would be to take that maple that has died here and that you're going to cut down. If you can get some of that root material along with the soil, and you can send that into the plant disease diagnostic lab, Brian Huddleston, he can look for verticillium and see.
I don't want to replace it with a maple if I'm going to wind up having that problem.
Right.
Yeah, right. So it'd be a good idea to know for sure. And as long as you dig out some of the roots and send that along with the soil, they should be able to look for it.
Cool. So if I can't replace it with a maple, what would you suggest?
Offhand, I'm trying to, you might...
Something like a maple?
Well...
Do you want to go to a... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no. It's just... the maple just gives us nice color and it's nice shade, but we're a small in town lot, so it's
okay.
Didn't know if there was maybe a better choice if we have to replace it anyway.
So let's say you do have verticillium, then kind of your next step, and this would apply to a whole range of circumstances, is you want to talk to one of your local nursery centers and try to match species with the growing conditions and the size that you want to fit your space, and try to boil it down to a handful of species that are going to do well given the site conditions, because the verticillium wilt isn't necessarily the only limiting factor, right? You don't want a huge tree in a small space, that kind of thing. And then once you've got that list and looked at plants, trees that you think you might like, then make sure that they can handle the verticillium.
All right.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Good luck, Karen.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Yep, bye. Appreciate your call. John in Wauwatosa. On to you now. Hi, John.
Hello. Hello. Thanks for the opportunity.
Sure.
I have two unrelated questions. The first one just came out this morning. My neighbor told me that his pole beans are first starting to produce. Of course, my bush beans, I've picking the last of them right now. And I was wondering if your guest had any varieties of pole beans that are producing in later in the season. I'd like to be able to have beans from July all the way through September if I could.
You're looking for later yielding bush beans, you said, or pole beans?
Pole beans. Well, he has pole beans, which are just beginning to produce right now.
Yep. Yeah, I don't have offhand variety names for pole beans that'll yield. When you dig through the nursery catalogs or the seed catalogs, look at the days till maturity, days till yield, and that'll give you a good idea. The other thing to keep in mind, and I like bush beans more than pole beans just because I think you get better yields and they're a little easier to manage. And the way you can extend that yield is just by what we call sequence planting. So you might plant some beans every 2 weeks, for example.
Yeah, we do that now. But
and you can get those well into late in the season. If you put floating row cover, you can get them even farther, but yeah, sorry, I don't have specific pole bean varieties, but
right.
The seed catalogs will give you some.
That was just a off-the-cuff one because I heard my neighbor's success this morning. The real question I have is a more serious one, and that is, unfortunately, in my lifetime, I've exposed myself to poison ivy way too many times, and I can hear the name poison ivy, and I begin to have rashes now. As a matter of fact, cashews bother me because I've been exposed too many times. I was exposed last summer by a very small plant, and I broke out right away. I cleaned up the area, did not burn anything, cleaned it up very meticulously. This last winter, I cut a box elder tree down in the area, and I burned the brush and raked the grass and picked up all the stuff from the tree and burned that also. And lo and behold, something in the smoke reacted with my skin and got me a rash again. I believe there was probably some snippings of a leaf left in the grass, something like that. I am afraid to go into that soil and touch it because I'm afraid the oils haven't broken down yet. How long would it take for the roots that are maybe left there or the oils are in that dirt to decompose so I can be safe to go back into that soil again?
Yeah, that's a good question. I
never had that question before.
Yeah. The volatility or the life of those oils. In an area like that, if you're that sensitive to it, even, just cutting it back or burning it off, that site is really never going to fully get rid of it. Really, the only thing that's going to work is turning that soil over, plowing it, and that's not something, you should be doing.
Well, that's exactly what I was doing. I was actually eradicating buckthorn.
Yeah.
I came across it, and I was like, and I'm actually digging out the roots of the buckthorn and pulling out the soil. So I'm going down about 6 inches into the soil, making sure it's clean of anything. And all of a sudden I said, oops, there's some, it was too late by that time.
Yeah.
And then I went and I still dug out the soil with tools and kept the tools, clean and so forth. I talked to a doctor friend of mine. He said that you can get poison ivy on a coat, hang it up in fall, and next fall when you take it off the coat rack to wear it again, you'll reinfect yourself with poison ivy because the oils are still on that coat. And I thought, well, that's not good news. So, but I think in the soil, there's got to be,
microorganisms or something that's working with it. Jason, what do you think?
Well, I mean, if you need to be in that area, as sensitive as you are, you're probably talking about some sort of soil sterilization, which you don't necessarily have to do chemically, but looking at an herbicide to kill all the vegetation, so you make sure you're killing any of the poison ivy that's there, and glyphosate would be adequate, Roundup. And then actually turning that over, aggressive tillage, either with deep rototilling or even turning it over with a shovel, and then planting a thick cover crop of some sort, and then tilling that in again. So you're basically just trying to eradicate that poison ivy. But, with your sensitivity and the likelihood for exposure, it sounds like someone else should be doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck, John. Thank you very much for calling. Jason Fishbach, Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties, our guest on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Far-ranging topics here today on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest Jason Fishbach, Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties. And we've talked about trees and we've talked about asparagus and let's see what else. A lot of different things with him today. You may have a question about your garden, and if you do, I hope you'll join in. We've got open lines to get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Jim in Poplar, you are next. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for the show. We have a couple of palm trees. They're probably 8 to 9 years old, maybe 7 to 10. But anyway, one on the bottom has got like a deep crease in it. And
you mean on the bottom of the base of the trunk?
Yes.
Okay.
And it looks like the leaves are getting a little yellow and they're starting to drop a little bit. I know it's getting toward fall, but this doesn't appear to be right to me. So you've got any idea what that would be? The bark is off around where the crease is.
Okay. So if you can go, at the bottom of the trunk and pull back the grass and the dirt a little bit, kind of dig around at the base of the trunk and see if you're seeing any sort of what we call mycelial fan. So those would be some kind of white thread-like fungus. And those would be some crown rotting fungi that would colonize and start interrupting with the flow of water and nutrients, and then that would cause some of the above ground symptoms that you're seeing, some leaf yellowing. It may be nothing. I mean, it may just be as the tree ages and the wood kind of has a different shape and if you have a crease, but it doesn't look like it's rotting or there's no amber kind of sap oozing out of the crack or anything. It may just be that the tree is maturing, right? It's just getting a little bit older. And this time of the year, we do, especially in the plums and apples and everything else, the leaves start yellowing and turning as they accumulate some of these fungal spores and lesions.
Okay.
But take a look at the base of the plum first.
My wife said she thought she seen a little bit of sap oozing out of that crease, and it looks awful dry there to me.
Yeah, it sounds like you may have a fungal infection, maybe even some bacterial problems that are colonizing that spot, too. Plums and cherries are difficult to grow. They tend to accumulate those kinds of problems. You could look at some fungicide treatments, and you're in Poplar, so I'm not too far from you. It might be best to just give me a call, and I might even be able to take a look at your trees for you, and we can look at your chemical control options if that's what you want to do.
All right. Sounds like a good deal to me, Jim.
Yes, it does. Say, I'd like to save the tree. We lost a plum tree here a couple of years ago that was producing very well, and it was almost mature, and then it just ended up dying. So we try to save these two that we have here.
If you can, okay. Well, give Jason a call. Maybe he'll come out and take a look. Thanks for calling. Art, who is on the road, up next. Hi, Art.
Hey, Larry. Got a question for Jason.
Yeah.
Does Jason know of any orchardists in the Bayfield area that are actually growing heirloom apples, particularly those that would be winter keepers? I think it's a missed opportunity.
Yeah, you bet. I would. There's a couple of them up there that do. Bayfield Apple Company's got, I think they might have 15 or 16 varieties.
Really?
Yep. Erickson's Orchard has a bunch. Most of those orchards up there have a pretty good diversity of apples. You know, they've diversified over the years. And
I have memories of Spitzenbergs that you couldn't bite into until after a heavy frost, and it would last virtually all winter in your cellar. You know, that's the kind of apple I'm thinking of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, Bayfield is, you know, becoming known as having that diversity of apples that people appreciate, some of these harder-to-find varieties. They've got a lot of those older trees. So if you're driving through the area, stop off at any of the orchards, but Bayfield Apple Company and Erickson's in particular have a pretty good diversity.
All right.
Okay, I'll try Erickson. Okay, thanks.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Chris in Evansville, hello to you.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about Russian olives. I'm actually looking at one right now, and I love the light green-gray color, and I tried to buy one and was told that they're not sold anymore because there's some toxic quality about a Russian olive. And so where can I get one? Is that true? And if I can get one, how do I prune them? It seems that they need a lot of regular pruning.
What do you think, Jason?
Well, you don't really like the Russian olives because they can be invasive. So if there's other opportunities or other shrubs that you like, it might be a better choice, which is why you're having it harder to find them.
Yeah, they are quite invasive, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You might be getting more than you bargained for with it, Chris.
Well, that's interesting because I do have neighbors who have a few, and they're tree-sized now, and it's just one single tree. That's interesting. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Gary in Rhinelander, it's your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. Hey, I've got a question about a potted tomato plant. Tomatoes are my favorites, and I definitely would like to be able to try to keep this plant growing through the winter. I do have a real nice window to do that. Is that possible?
Yeah, it can be. You know, tomatoes are perennial. They'll keep growing until something kills them, usually frost. The main thing is you want to think about as you transition it into, is bringing any pests into the house with you. And you kind of have to think of bringing it inside gradually. You may want to treat it with some safer soap or some other fairly safe insecticides to knock back any thrips or anything. I mean, part of the problem with tomatoes is they just get so big, of course. But you can, through some regular pruning, try to keep it manageable. Is it something you can accommodate size-wise?
Yes, it is. Yeah, we have a nice base window, in the kitchen and such, and it would definitely fit in there very easily.
Well,
so the other one would be keeping it watered and looking at some sort of a slow-release fertilizer if those keep growing. Okay. And you may need supplemental light to keep it vigorous, especially as it moves in. It might get even more spindly and even more growth than you can handle. But, hey, if you've got it in a pot, give it a try.
Okay. How about if I begin growing tomato seeds right now and in 2 months' time, you know, I should be able to maybe produce some tomatoes as well?
In theory, if you had enough heat and you had enough
light,
you could probably pull it off. But you're gonna need more than just your standard fluorescent grow lights to
okay.
pull it off. You're gonna need some pretty high octane lights to get the light intensity you need, both to the good vigorous growth and the flowering.
Okay, yeah. By the time you do all that,
they're pretty expensive.
Pretty expensive tomatoes.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, that's a per tomato cost there would be pretty high. Suzanne in Madison, on to you. Hi.
Hi there. I have a magnolia tree in my yard. It's not a star. I can't remember what variety it is. And it's about 10 years old, and this year it's doubled in growth, but there are very few of the buds for next year to flower. And I was wondering if there's anything I can do this late. I mean, it seems like there's very, like, a handful of buds to flower for next spring.
Okay, but you've got plenty of vigorous vegetative growth?
Yes, lots. I mean, it's twice the size of it, that it was last year.
Okay. It sounds to me like it wants to be growing and becoming a big tree, and it's not really interested in flowering quite yet or to that degree. And that, to me, points to you've got really nice growing condition for that tree, which may – have you been adding supplemental fertilizer or anything?
No, nothing. But it's just it just took off this year where it's – every year it's been kind of spindly, and this year it's just full and very – it's doing very well.
Okay. Well, I think – most likely what's going to happen is the next year you're going to have double the tree this year. Next year you'll have double the blossoms. I think it invested most of its energy into growing this year. I think you'll just have to deal with fewer blooms next year. But then as it starts to reach its mature height and size, it'll continue to flower.
Okay, great.
All right. Thanks, Suzanne.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Tina in Elgin, Illinois. Hi there.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Jason. I've got we planted three dogwood bushes about 3 years ago, and they became very leggy. And so I thought, okay, this will be a good time after they flower in this season to cut back some of the branches and try and get them to grow a little bit more robust. And not even a week after I had done that, one of the bushes just completely went brown on us, and all of the leaves withered, dried up. And I thought maybe I had infected the plant with something that was maybe on the surface of the cistus that I was using. But then I noticed about a week later that the lawn and the ground around that shrub turned brown. And I don't know if that's a coincidence, and I don't know whether this is a pest problem or if there's something else I should be looking at.
Do you live out in the country?
No, it's suburban.
Okay.
And the other two shrubs are fine.
Hmm. I was thinking of some sort of herbicide drift issue, but that's me. I'm not the expert. What do you think, Jason?
Well, that's a kind of a stumper with the grass dying as well. Do you have any reason to suspect herbicides?
I hadn't sprayed anything else in the area, not even close, actually. And it's an eastern exposure. There's actually partial shade during part of the morning and most of the afternoon. And the only other thing that is remotely affecting this, I'm thinking, is that we've had sort of a chronic anthill in that area, but we haven't really been throwing any diazinon or anything on it. We haven't really been treating it with anything. We just kind of let the ants go.
Okay.
Yeah, the ants wouldn't cause that.
Right. So when you see a shrub or a tree collapse like that, you either suspect some sort of a bacterial blight, something like you'd see fire blight in apple trees where everything just collapses and dies, or you would suspect a root rotting problem, either a bacterial or fungal disease, and both of those are caused by sudden wilting and death. But, you know, bacterial blights are not going to bother the lawn around it.
Yeah.
And root rotting fungi, I don't know them well enough if they would also have some effect on the surrounding grass. But, you know, that might be a place to start is poke around on Google, like if you want to start there, and look at dogwood shrub diseases. And when you, this is a tip for any search anyone does, any of these gardening topics, plug in the word extension at the end of your search terms, and you're going to get the extension pages from across the U.S. That might be a place to start and to see if anything matches up. Other than that, when you see multiple plants across families dying, you know, it's very rare that that happens unless there's
herbicides
involved.
Yeah.
Some other mechanical damage or...
All right, well, hopefully it doesn't affect the other two. I'll do that search. Thank you for that.
And one thing with the pruning the shrubs, dogwoods in particular, you really can't prune them hard enough. And if you're really looking for them to become more robust and thicker with more branches but not quite so tall, consider coppicing them. And you do that in the late winter, early spring. Just cut it right down to the ground. And by the end of the year, you're going to have as much, if not more, growth than you had the year before and you cut it. Otherwise, we planted some at the Ashland County Courthouse as a planting, and those things, we can't keep them under control. They just grow and grow and grow. So we're real vigorous. No matter how hard we cut them, they keep coming back.
There you go. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I had a caller in Foxborough who wonders, when's the best time to divide irises and lilies?
Now I believe we're entering that season. You
can yeah.
get in there and you can divide them, and you want to kind of sort through, and any of those the bulbs or rhizomes that look off, they smell bad, or somehow show signs that they're not healthy, get rid of those and then plant out the better ones. And you don't need to plant them very deep. You can even have the, you know, still poking their noses out.
That's fine.
And
yep.
a little compost on top can help, or mulch.
An email from Karen in Madison. How can I encourage my root vegetables, such as beets and turnips, to develop bigger root bulbs? Also, I have several broccoli plants that have not yet made florets. Any suggestions for those?
The broccoli should still flower. Just give it time. The bulbing on the root crops, that's probably more of a plant vigor or fertility issue, making sure there's adequate fertilizer in those soils or adequate nutrients.
Yeah, you need to throw a little fertilizer in there. Sarah in Zion, Illinois, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm growing these Russian heirloom tomatoes, which are, by the way, incredibly delicious. They're called Black Crim. But, you know, I thought that this story was tomatoes were native to the Americas. Is that true? So how did they end up being developed in Russia?
Boy, oh boy, oh boy, I don't know about that one. If, you know, we have a lot of plants here that we got from Europe.
You know, the tomatoes have a long history, and they plants have been moving across continents for, you know, thousands of years, and I suspect they went to Europe or even straight to Russia first, and then growers with their heirloom and seed saving developed varieties, then they came back the other way.
Yeah, that's so cool.
It is.
And then I just wanted to mention that I thought that Mr. Stripey, some of those just are green. They never turn red. They're always green.
Yeah, well,
they're ripe then.
The picture on the showed them as red and yellow. That's why I thought, well, maybe I'll pull one off and just try it and see.
Well, I've seen a picture. You know, I did grow one also, and I'm trying to remember what the heck happened to it. But I think I think there are some that stay green and some that turn something or other.
The picture they showed me, or the picture on the, you know, inside
right.
that you get inside the little pot was.
Well, I guess that would be then the way it is.
Well, it could have been mislabeled. You know, there's always that. That happens, doesn't it, Jason?
Every once in a while, yep.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling, Sarah. Thanks for that tip. I'm going to try one of those.
Okay.
Just to see. Oh, Michael in Marquette, Michigan. Your turn. Hi, Michael.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good.
Good. Hey, I this year planted a tomatillo plant amongst several tomato plants. And we're up in, I think, you know, up right next to Lake Superior, so we have a very short growing season. But while all of my tomato plants have produced fruit, nothing, and I mean nothing, has come on the tomatillo plant. It did flower, and I'm just wondering, I mean, did you have to plant more than one of those plants to get them to fertilize? Or, with, you know, I'm just curious, what did I do wrong? Or is there still time left in the season for something to develop?
Tomatillos? I didn't hear.
Yeah, tomatillos.
Yeah. You had just one plant?
Just one plant.
Okay. And I don't know offhand if they're self-fertile. I suspect they probably are. So they should have pollinated. Though even with self-fertile plants, if you do have multiple varieties or you get some cross-pollination, you're going to have more vigorous, more robust fruit. So that would be my guess why you weren't seeing any fruit development. Did you notice anything? I mean, the other option could be the flowers themselves died. If they're lower down in the tomatoes, if they happen to have more disease pressure, or if it just was hotter down there, you know, those flower blossoms will abort if they get too hot or too cold.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't notice that. I was just really curious, you know, would it cross-pollinate with a tomato, since it originally, you know, was a hybrid of that.
Yeah, I would suspect there's no reason why I can think of that you wouldn't have had pollination.
But the month of July, if you had weather like we had, it was very, very hot.
Right. And if you didn't have any air movement and it was sort of buried in the canopy, it probably got even hotter.
Yep. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, guys.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Irma in Glendale, on to you. Hi, Irma.
Hi. Last year, I planted asparagus, and it came up this year very spindly and skinny, and I didn't pick any of it, and it's just sitting in the garden, and number one, should I cut the tops off now? And number two, how can I amend the soil to maybe get a better plant next year?
Yeah, so that's about right for the first year. It's not going to amount to much. And I would just leave those seed stocks until the spring when the snow melts and you get out there and clean them up. And the main thing would be to help that plant with just keeping the weeds down, you know, hand weeding. And then in the spring, looking at some fertility, you have to look up the guidelines. It's just a small amount of say, 10-10-10 that you'd sprinkle on. And you can actually top dress with compost, that can help as well. Mm-hmm. But the main thing, if you want healthy asparagus, give it some time. And if the soil is well prepared so that the water drains, keeping the weeds down, that should be about all you have to do.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, some folks don't even pick the asparagus the second year after planting to help it get a nice, big, vigorous crown. But
we had an email from Linda in Stratford. I want to do some new landscaping around my house, and I need to move on azalea, hydrangea, butterfly bush, floribunda rose, and high bush cranberry. When's the best time to do this, and do I prune and then move?
Before the contractor gets there with the backhoe is probably the best time to move them. At this point, it's, you know, we're later in the season. You can pretty much move anything. I mean, if it has to be moved, it has to be moved.
Yeah.
You know, once you hit September 1st, you can feel pretty comfortable, mainly because you're worried about the heat and the drought stressing a newly transplanted shrub. But at this time of year, you should be okay. Just make sure there's good watering. And you know, the later you can wait here toward mid-September would be better. But especially where they're from?
Stratford.
Okay. You can wait a little bit longer in the season, but in September anyway.
And, you know, that you mentioned watering. That reminded me. It's something I want to make a point to mention as we get into and through the fall season, the whole business of watering your trees and shrubs if they're not getting adequate moisture right up until about frost.
You know, that's a great segue to plug, not to forget about those raspberry patches.
Yes.
We've seen a lot of problems, at least up here this last couple of years, with cane blight. And that's because folks aren't taking out the spent floor canes, and they're not pruning adequately and adequate weed control during the growing season. So now, easy to forget, right? They're all done bearing. But get in there, cut those floor canes out, do a real nice weeding this year. Probably just have to do one more. and even thin back some of those primacanes so you're set up for next year. And water the raspberries. I mean, they've got fruit buds, and they need vigorous growth.
They need water, too.
You're growing next year's crop, right, these next the August and September.
Jim in Waupun, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thank you for this great program. My question is, I'm fairly certain that my purple autumn ash is infected with ash flower gall. How can I treat that?
Ash flower gall.
I'm not sure if it's, how big is it?
It's about 25 feet tall. It has a crown that's about 18 to 20 feet.
Okay. The only, you know, option, because it's sort of a foliar applied insecticide, is too big for that feasibly. So you'd have to look at a systemic kind of a root drench that gets moved up in the tree. But I don't know offhand whether there are labeled insecticides for the ash gall. Have you seen it every year?
No, it's first year.
First year, okay. Now, you know, it's a fairly periodic kind of infection that you get. You typically don't see it every year in the ash trees.
Will it kill the tree?
No, it definitely won't kill the tree. It just affects the flowers.
Oh, okay.
And so it looks kind of unsightly, and those will stay on the tree well into the winter, even next spring. But typically it doesn't bother the tree. If you start seeing it again next year and the year after, we can look at some options. But if this is the first year, I would just ignore it and say, wow, nature does funny things.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jason Fishbach, our guest, UW Extension Ag Agent from Ashland and Bayfield Counties, here on Garden Talk. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jason Fishbach, our guest on this edition of Garden Talk, thank you so much for listening, and I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate all of the questions and comments that we get. You can join in by going to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a comment or a photo there. Email us at talk@WPR.org or call at 1-800-642-1234. Jason, we had a Facebook comment from Ellen, who, this goes back to the tomatillos. She says, tomatillos need to cross-pollinate.
Okay.
So, got that. Karen in Edgerton emailed us wondering about her purple coneflowers. They're about done blooming. Is this a good time to transplant some of them to another location? And if not, when?
If they're done blooming and the foliage is starting to turn, I'd say go for it. You know, mine are still blooming. Certainly, you've still got plenty of time, so you might err on the side of caution here and just wait another couple of weeks.
I think it's probably a good idea. Sean Sean in Appleton, hello to you.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a couple of hanging strawberry planters that I started this year, and they gave me a great first batch of strawberries early in the year. They're ever-bearing. But now I'm starting to get some additional strawberries right now, and I'm seeing right when they become ripe enough to pick, I'm getting very small holes on them. They're very shallow, and they're pretty small, maybe 3 or 4 millimeters in diameter, and they're circular. And I don't know what's causing them. I haven't seen any birds over there. I know that there's a few ants that I see once in a while on the planters, but that's it. What could be causing that?
They're turning ripe, so they're red?
Yep, right. Okay. Right when they're just about ready to pick, that's when the holes develop, and they actually tend to develop overnight. They'll be fine the morning before or the evening before, and then the next morning they've got, you know, 2 or 3, sometimes even 5 of these little holes on them.
Okay, now they're hanging, so they're up off the ground?
Yes, they are.
Okay, you know, I don't know specifically, but I'll give you some ideas here, and you could do a little bit more digging, try to find out. The one option might be tarnished plant bug can sometimes do some feeding. Another one might be something like picnic beetles, but that would be, well, with a hanging basket, probably not. It could be flea beetles that are up in there chewing on it. I was going to say, if it's happening overnight, it could be slugs, but
no,
they're hanging.
Not if it's hanging, probably.
Right, unless they're able to crawl up. But, you know, we've got a greenhouse, and it's amazing how high up the plastic those things will crawl.
Is that right?
Find them in the morning, they're halfway up the plastic. So, you know, the best thing you could probably do is go out there at night with a flashlight and see if you can find the critter.
Okay.
So we get a positive ID. But, you could start with those suggestions, see if anything matches up. But otherwise, just go out there at night with a flashlight, see if you can find something.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Mary in Heartland, on to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, a couple things. One thing, is it too early to start pruning ash trees, white ash?
Yeah, with any trees, I don't like fall pruning. I think you're better off at this point waiting until the leaves are down.
Dormant time.
Yep, and even if you can wait till after the end of the new year, I think that's even better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the other thing is I had planted a flowering crab a couple falls ago, and this spring it had some kind of a worm in it that ate the blossoms, so consequently no fruit. And what would I do to prevent that from happening next year?
So you had blossoms, but then you didn't have
any. No blossoms. There's a little worm in there, and it never flowered, and it, of course, never fruited either.
Okay, so in the actual bud, you found a little worm that was...
Yeah, right at the tips of where the leaf and the bud would be coming out.
Hmm.
And I really had to look for a long time to find it. It was tiny, with a little white thing with a black eye, I would think it was.
Okay, yeah, I don't know offhand. That might be a question for our insect specialist, Phil Pelletieri. You can look at, if you get a positive ID on what the bug is, you can look at a insecticide application well before bloom, right?
Right. Yeah, I didn't think anything bothered the flowering crabs much, but there it was.
No. Yeah, I don't know of any larvae that are, offhand that are feeding on those flower buds and crab.
Okay. Okay, I'll have
sorry
to call
that.
Back.
Yeah, or, go to the insect diagnostic lab, the UW-Madison insect diagnostic lab. You might be able to pose a question there to Phil.
Okay, I'll try that then.
Thanks. All right. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Email from Ed in Madison, and this is for the person or anybody who wants a pole bean. He says the best one I've ever grown is Fortex, Fortex, a French fillet type, which is flavorful, tender. Beans are young and slender. As they get larger, they can reach 10 inches. Production's fantastic. He is quite effusive in his praise for Fortex. And big crop in July with a short break. Now it's producing at full speed again by the bucketfuls. It freezes well, too. That's from Ed in Madison. And Susie in New Berlin has a question, so let's go to Susie. Hi, Suze.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I've got a question about endless summer hydrangeas. I have three of them. I've had them planted for about, this would be their fourth season. Last fall, I took them down to the ground, as advised to do, and this summer they bushed out, but there were no blooms on them. I'm wondering, what did I do wrong?
Endless Summer, do you know the variety name?
I know that they're Endless Summer Hydrangeas. I don't know the variety.
Okay. I'm trying to think why you wouldn't, unless it wasn't an Endless Summer. But you're pretty sure. And
I'm positive, yes.
The plan was to cut it back to the ground. Yeah, you should have seen some blooms.
Stumped?
Yeah, Larry, you have any ideas?
I'm racking my brains here, and I can't think of any reason why that would have happened.
Do you see any sort of insect or disease problem? Did you see flower buds that started open then didn't?
One of the bushes did have one bloom, and that was the only bloom. And then some of the leaves did have that little rust disease, the little brown spots. Mm-hmm. So I removed all the leaves that had those spots on them, and then I noticed that helped because I didn't see any more of the leaves with that spot, those brown spots, but then there were no blooms. There's many leaves, but there are no blooms.
Was it fertilized?
No.
Was not fertilized heavily with nitrogen?
No.
Oh, you got me. Maybe somebody else will have an idea about this. I hope so. Hang, stay listening, Susie. We'll see what we can come up with. All right. Thank you for calling. That's. I bet you we get an email on that from somebody or a call. Roland in West Bend, we go to you now. Hi, Roland.
Hi. Here's my question. We have a maple tree. We put mulch around a lot of our trees and shrubs, and we have a Rose of Sharon that's been great for, we've had it for a number of years, and all of a sudden, like segments of it, the leaves start turning yellow like it's dying. So we scrape the mulch away from that, and we put a disinfectant that's supposed to kill anything that'd be in the roots. Now my wife just bought me a leaf from our maple tree, which also has mulch around it, and it's got five round spots almost the size of a dime on it. And she says the leaves are looking wilted, and all the leaves have this on like it's some kind of blight. Have you any ideas what that is?
So it's a big brown kind of blackish spot on the leaves?
Yeah.
I wonder if that might be tar spot of maple.
Yeah.
It's a pretty common
sounds like it
this time of year, and it'll defoliate the tree, but at this time of the year, it doesn't really bother it. And it's blown in off leaf material that, you know, if somebody didn't rake them all up, it overwinters on the leaves and then blows back up into the tree. So it sounds like tar spot of maple.
Yeah. Where'd you get, what kind of mulch do you have?
It's colored. It's a, like,
okay.
Earth colored.
So it wasn't something from the neighborhood, okay.
So
that
so
probably
anyway, you don't
do
think
it.
It's the mulch causing the problem.
I don't think so.
So
what can we do?
Okay, so there's just nothing to do. Let the leaves, when they finish, drop off and rake them up, and hope next year we won't get it. Then I guess. So
yeah, right.
It's not going to kill the tree, is what I'm saying.
No, if it's a younger tree, you know, and you get year after year, it can this late in the season, you can have some problems, but. But we saw this go through Washburn last year. Almost all the maple trees had it, and this year I haven't seen hardly any. So typically it's just you get it some years. And
you like that maple tree, keep watering it right up, and, you know, give it, if it's not getting rain, give it water right up until freeze up.
We've done that a number of times. The fact that you put one of these probes in the ground to get it around where the roots are and left it on there for like almost an hour, and we've watered it periodically because we haven't had any rain for so long. So it's not lack of water. We pretty well can take care of that because of the long spell. So.
I was just thinking of it in terms of getting it through as healthy as possible to next spring.
So, okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, Roland. Yeah, appreciate the call. Peggy in Two Harbors wonders, is this also a good time to move Solomon seal or false Solomon seal plants?
Let's see. I think, are they, depends when they bloom. I think they bloom during the summer, so
yeah.
At this point it would be fine after they've bloomed. Again, you know, we're September, early September here, so we've still got a number of weeks before we really need to worry about transplanting. So you could hold off until mid-September or so.
And an email from Tad, this is my second summer for my 25 hazelnut trees. A couple look great, but a few have very yellow leaves. What could be wrong? They're all in tree tubes and have had organic 511 fertilizer applied this summer.
Some of the leaves are turning yellow within the tree tubes? That was the question.
It doesn't say within the tree tubes, but it could be.
Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to think, hazelnuts, what would be causing these yellowish leaves?
Yeah, well, you're involved with that Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Initiative, aren't you?
Yeah, and we, you know, unless we see that the plant is stressed and water stressed, we don't. The leaves are usually vigorous and green year after year. That might be my guess. If it would be some moisture stress, the hazelnuts are pretty finicky. If they get stressed by drought, they just curl up their leaves and drop them, and they're typically fine if it happens later in the season. The buds are set and they grow out next year. That would be one thing to look at, is have, especially newly planted hazelnuts. They're pretty finicky, and so if you don't get enough water, or if there's competition with weeds stealing the water, they'll do what they do when they get stressed and just kind of go dormant.
Yep. Bonnie in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Bonnie.
Hello, gentlemen. I have a question regarding my perennial garden.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what I should start doing now and what I should do later September, October, in preparation of, you know, putting it down for winter.
This is, you're getting ready to transplant?
No, just
to button it up.
Yeah, just to clean it up and make sure, you know, that I'm reducing the likelihood of any diseases as well as to help it possibly thrive for next spring.
Okay. Sure. Yeah, the you can clean up some of the older plants with the leaf material, and now would be a good time to actually put some more mulch down between the plants if you want, so that you can suppress any sort of weed germination in the spring. Poke around for any winter annuals, like yellow rocket or something that might be coming through that would make weeds for next year, so you can pull those out. And then the main thing is you want to leave as much of that tall growth, the flower stalks and even some of the leaves. What they'll do is when the snows come and sometimes they turn to ice as they freeze and thaw, is it'll actually make a little air channel. And so you get better air underneath the snow to the plant, and so your plants have a better chance of surviving the winter and doing just fine. So you don't want to cut everything down to the ground, plus
no.
It adds some winter interest.
Yeah, adds a lot of winter interest. Very good. Thank you very much for calling, Bonnie. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, Jason Fishbach, Extension Agriculture Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're in Garden Talk right now with Jason Fishbach, Extension Agriculture Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties. Great to have him along. He's with us by phone today, and you can join us by phone, too, if you want. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us, talk@wpr.org, or go to our Facebook page and post there, at The Larry Mueller Show. And, Jason, we have Al in Madison, who's been waiting a while. So let's get to Al. Hi, Al. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. One is concerning some raspberries I planted this year. I have about five plants, and they're around 2 feet tall each. What do I need to do to prepare them for the winter?
Yeah, at this point, so keep in mind the first year after planting, the plants can sometimes look a little wimpy, and that's okay. So the main thing is weed control going into the year, making sure, because if you have any quack grass or anything else, now's the time to get it out, so that when spring comes around, the first thing growing is the raspberries, not the weeds. Other than that, there's really nothing to do. You may have had some new shoots off the handle. That's basically that piece of dried wood that comes with the plant in the spring. You may have shoots that grew and set some fruit. You can prune those off, but all the new primacanes that didn't have any fruit this year, leave those because that's next year's floricanes. That's about it for the fall. Just keep it well watered, and then in the spring, that's where all the action is. So that's where you keep the weeds out, and then you'll fertilize at bud break, and you'll fertilize at bloom with some nitrogen fertilizer. And you should have what you're looking for in the second year is, you know, a little bit of harvest off those overwintered primacanes, and then a bunch of new shoots. And you want to kind of manage those. That row no more than about 2 feet wide. The narrower, the better. And so with your mower, as you get a bunch of new shoots, you can narrow those rows, just mow them down.
Okay. My other question is, I have three northern hardy kiwi plants, and they've grown up into my pine trees. They're about 30 feet tall. These were planted by a previous owner. And when is the best time to trim those? I need to get them down. I can't really enclose them, and the birds ate all my fruit this year. So I want to cut them out of the trees. When is the best time to do that?
I'd wait till they're, you know, after a couple of good hard freezes and everything's good and dead, or dormant, I should say. And then, you know, those, if you don't want them growing in those trees, you can cut them down, you know, basically coppice them. And then the new shoots next year, you can manage those onto a trellis or some other direction to keep them out of the trees.
Mm-hmm.
But any pruning, just wait till it's till they're dormant.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks very much for calling. And Carla in Dubuque, Iowa. On to you now. Hi, Carla.
Hi. I have a question. I have a very mature magnolia tree in my back, and I noticed this spring the leaves are coming in, and they're a lot smaller. And the leaves on the bottom are larger, but they're not as big as they usually are. And as it goes up towards the top, especially on one side, they're small. It flowered, but it seemed like I know they don't stay on long, but it seemed like the flowers didn't stay on long at all.
On the new shoots, did you see much for elongation? I mean, how long are your is the new growth?
It's an awful big tree. It seems like the new growth, yeah, there's a lot of new growth, actually.
Shorter than normal, or?
If that's new, I guess it would be longer.
Longer than normal, okay.
Yeah. Hmm.
Doesn't fit the pattern.
No.
You know, if you're seeing small leaves, if the tree just doesn't look particularly thrifty, for some reason that tree is under stress, so we kind of have to go through the usual suspects. Was there some sort of damage to the trunk? Is there were there obvious disease or insect problems in the canopy? If things just, you don't see spots, you don't see holes shoot out of the leaves, but just kind of not very thrifty, then you suspect some sort of root rot problem.
Oh, yeah, because leaves look, I mean, you know, there are no holes or brown spots or anything on the leaves.
Okay. And when it comes to root rotting fungi in trees, our options are very limited other than just trying to, hopefully that tree can fight it off itself with, you know, adequate watering, maybe a little bit of fertility in the spring, but a full-grown tree like that's probably not going to need much. I would, you know, just see what happens next year. It's really your only option at this point. You could try to excavate some root and soil and send it in to see if you can, if they can isolate any pathogens in that soil.
Oh, okay.
Other than that, hopefully it's just kind of a fluke year and everything. You know, the fact that you had some of that vigorous growth, even more than usual, to me suggests that perhaps that tree is still okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'd give it another year and see
Okay. Now, when you said to feed it, what would I mean, what would the ratio be? What would the what kind of...
To feed it?
Fertilize it?
You know, a tree that old, I wouldn't fertilize it at this point. Particularly, you have grass underneath that tree?
Yes.
Yeah, the grass is just going to steal most of that nitrogen anyway. If you've got that growth, good vigorous growth, you've most likely got enough nitrogen. So let's just assume that it's some other, you know, unfortunately, a root rotting pathogen or something else, and let's see if the tree can fight it off.
Okay. Do you know, like, the life of the tree, a magnolia like this?
You know, I don't offhand. Oftentimes, it's totally associated. The life expectancy is with the site. Is there any ponding of water or any sort of, does it dry out fairly quickly after a rain?
Well, because my backyard is a sloping hill, and so I would think that the water wouldn't just sit there because it's on the
slope.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's typically, if a tree's going to die, if it's not a lightning strike or a windstorm or something else, it's usually root-rotting fungi that, in the first trees to go, and it might take, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50 years to happen. It'll be the trees that are wettest, of the wettest soils on average. But if you're on a nice slope, it shouldn't be an issue. But you never know when these things are going to strike either.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
One last thing, too, is just to take a look at the crown or at the trunk of the tree, at the base, kind of like the plum from an earlier caller. Mm-hmm. Just see if you see any obvious fungal growth at the base of the tree.
Okay. All right.
All right. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Becky in Milwaukee. We'll move right along here. Hi, Becky. Becky, are you there? Did I do something? No, Becky's not there. Lois in Lancaster, let's go to you. Hi, Lois.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and I have two questions. The one is, do tomatoes cross when they're set close together? Because I have one yellow tomato plant, and now I've got one of my red tomato plants that is getting some that are...
Yellow?
Yellow and red, right. And those are huge. I measured one. It was 14 inches in diameter and 15 and a half inches in circumference.
Well,
so,
good size.
And I have so many, I don't know what I'm going to do. It's yellow tomatoes. I made some jam out of some, but there's a lot of them.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of that crossing?
Well, they will cross-pollinate, but that won't affect the fruit on that particular plant. It'll, if you save seed from that plant, the fruit on the next one will look different.
But I've got some on the one plant has both kinds. It has a red tomato and one that's yellow and red.
Huh. It could just be a little bit of uneven ripening. Sometimes.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too.
Okay.
With temperatures and sun exposure.
Okay. All right. Then my other question is, how do I keep the bugs off the broccoli?
Do you know what kind bugs?
Well, they're worms.
Oh, you've got the loopers?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's two products that are both pretty effective. There's a BT product, sometimes sold as Dipel. There's a bunch of different brand names, but what you're looking for is the active ingredient.
I don't want to use any chemicals.
Okay. Then you're going to have to hand pick. Or what you can do at this time of the year is you can, when it's not so hot, you can cover it with floating row cover.
Yeah.
And then the moths can't lay their eggs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got them covered with a sheer curtain.
The okay. BT, by the way, though, is it not considered an organic?
It is. It's a bacterially derived protein that interferes with the gut of the caterpillars, and so they basically stop feeding and kills them that way. There's another product, spinosad, which is similar. It's a naturally derived pesticide, insecticide, and both of them are considered not toxic and safe to use, and both are very effective. Both are.
Is it BT? B as in boy.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
BT.
Bacillus thuringiensis.
Yep. And then spinosad is sold oftentimes as a potato bug killer. It just depends on the brand, but the main thing you're looking for, the active ingredient, spinosad.
Spinosad.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
All right.
Sometimes in broccoli, they don't. Those little worms, by the time you pick them, they haven't done a lot of damage. So just dunking them in cold water, you can kind of rinse them off. But
in hot water.
Cold water.
Cold water.
Cold water. Okay.
But inevitably, you're gonna probably bite into one of them.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I'm thinking years back when I was trying to impress a young lady, before I was married, and I made this great salad for her at my home, and from the garden, and there was a big worm right in the middle of her salad. Wasn't very impressive. Well, she was impressed. She was excited. I can tell you that. Zora in Muskego, it's your turn. Hi.
Hey, hi. Thanks for taking my call. She just had a little extra meat on her dinner plate. That time, right? Listen, I have an area that is about 4.5 feet wide, and it's up against the house. We took some things out there, and I'm looking for a taller shrub, like a 5 to 6 foot tall shrub, but something that is not wide. And something that is not, that does not have deep roots. What would you suggest?
I don't know about the rooting habit necessarily, but I like those dogwoods because they're pretty shrubs. You get a lot of foliage. You can buy all shapes and sizes and colors, and you get pretty flowers. And during the winter, you've got some color around your house with the red twigs or the yellow twigs.
Okay, now
and you can manage their height. With aggressive pruning. I mean, you could cut them back every year, and you're going to, it's going to look great.
Okay, that sounds good, but I wouldn't, a red twig sounds really great, but I wouldn't want it to get real wide, you understand?
Yep.
And then who would be able to tell me how deep the roots are? I have wires, underground wires there, and they're 24 inches below. I'm hoping that would be safe.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the nurseries that you would be buying the plants with will have some sense of the rooting depth on most of these. But, you know, almost all your shrubs, depending on where the water supply is, are going to send the roots below 24 inches,
okay.
No matter what shrub you're growing. You might look at,
I was thinking of like a flowering almond maybe, because they're not as wide, aren't they? More.
Yeah, and some of the evergreen shrubs, if you're interested, some of those gold-leafed evergreen shrubs.
Yeah, those are pretty.
Okay.
And those are pretty easy to grow, too.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Robin in Green Bay wonders, I'd like to use some leaf compost to mulch a bed with perennials and shrubs, but I'm concerned about stimulating late-season growth. Would it be safe to top-dress now and dig it in the spring?
Yeah, I don't see why not.
Yeah.
It shouldn't really trigger new growth on those plants.
That's a pretty slow.
For sure. There's really not much in there from a nitrogen standpoint.
Yeah. Chris in Merrimack, hi to you.
Hi there. I've got a problem with Japanese beetles, and last year they totally decimated a grapevine that I have, and then this year they just nailed a purple plum, and they're attacking my crab apple. And I've heard people talk about systemic applications. I don't know what that is. Is that a thing you put on the ground that goes up the roots?
Yeah, that's how systemics would work. I don't know what's labeled for use with the Japanese beetle. We do have a real nice publication on your insecticide options for Japanese beetle. It's on the Wisconsin Horticulture website. There's probably a link to it from Larry's page.
Yes. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show, and we'll link you right to that extension page.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. There is one that is used that I know of, and I can't think of the name of it right now. But it actually just makes the leaves not taste good.
Okay. You know, believe it or not, we don't have Japanese beetle this far north, and thankfully
you'll get them.
So we don't have to deal with them yet.
Eau Claire, they're now in force in Eau Claire. The good thing is, in having Phil Pelletieri on the show the other day. We were talking about this. They seem to go through a cycle. In Madison, they were just horrendous and over several years, but they've died back. I mean, there's still pockets where they're bad, but I had a grape arbor like on our driveway, and I might have had two or three Japanese beetles, and that's it. And they love grape. They love grapes. Yeah, so they may be on their way.
We're told the larva won't survive the winter, so I hope that's true.
Well, they're in Eau Claire. It gets pretty cold there. Yeah. Marty in Spring Prairie, we turn to you. Hi.
Hi. I have some real disappointing Brussels sprouts. This is the second year in a row. Is there something I should be doing that I'm not doing? Or?
They're not. What's wrong?
They're leafy and wimpy, and they don't form the sort of nice, tight little cabbagettes.
Yep. Okay.
That I like to see.
Are you starting your own plants?
Yes.
Okay. And when do you transplant them out?
Real early.
Okay.
Right after, around the last frost.
All right. And the pH? Do you know the pH of your soil?
Pretty alkaline.
Okay. The only thing I could think of to get the good tight heads in the little Brussels sprouts would be adequate nitrogen fertilizer. The brassicas are real heavy feeders, and both at planting and about 4 weeks after planting, a good shot of ideally a slow release nitrogen, and to give that plant, because you want a real nice vigorous plant before it starts forming the Brussels sprouts.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not adequate growth, then you don't get very good Brussels sprouts.
Does the plant need to be topped off?
No.
No. Okay, they should just appear.
Yep.
Okay. Wow. More intensive fertilization.
Yeah, I try. Find a nice spot. Do you grow beans or peas in your garden?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Use that ground to grow your Brussels sprouts next year. And you might, if you can, fork in some rotted manure or compost this fall in with the beans. You don't even have to pull those beans or peas out. Just turn all that in, let it rot down, and then in the spring you can plant and add a little fertilizer at planting, and then some at about 4 weeks after. And hopefully you'll have adequate fertility because you'll have some of the nitrogen carry over from the peas.
Okay.
And actually, Larry, if we have time, there's a nice strategy for gardens in terms of preparing for the fall.
Yes.
Is we've got a lot of ground in our garden that's just growing weeds, right? So the peas and all the other crops that have finished for the year. Now is a great time, early September, go in there, put in some soil amendments, some organic matter, whatever you've got, fork it in, and then make a decent seed bed, just rake it, and then you plant annual ryegrass, sometimes sold as Italian ryegrass. That stuff will grow on cement. It's fantastic. You just sprinkle it on, lightly rake it in, and maybe a little water, and that stuff will grow and grow and grow. The frost doesn't kill it, so it grows well late into the fall. And you'll get, if you plant early September, a good foot at least. Now, the beauty is that winter kills. So now you're left with all this organic matter. That stuff will have sopped up any excess nitrogen. Then you just till that in, and you can transplant into it directly if you want, or you can till it in and seed it down. So it's a real nice strategy here in the northern climates for incorporating a row crop or a cover crop.
Yeah, that's a great idea. You know, I almost forgot to mention that you're doing an all things allium workshop next week, Jason. First, what falls in the allium family, and what are some key things to know about growing them?
Yeah, so garlic, leeks, onions, and the focus of my talk will be decorative onions. You know, we have basically one good option, daffodils, for spring flowering bulbs, because the deer and everybody else eats the rest of them for the most part.
Yep.
But they don't like the decorative onions. So things like, you know, everyone knows about the Globemaster, those big, super tall flowering onions, but there's a whole bunch of them in the allium family that will flower in the late spring, early summer. And you plant them in September, just like your daffodils and tulips. And they can add a lot of interest to your garden. So we'll be talking about Star of Persia and the drumsticks and the whole range of decorative alliums.
Can people still get involved in that workshop?
Yeah, it's held in Ashland, Bayfield County at the Old Ashland Ag Research Station, and it's next Thursday, September 8th. And they're taking registrations. It's being hosted by the Ashland Bayfield Master Gardener Association.
So go to the Ashland Bayfield Master Gardeners Association website, and they will find that information there.
Yep, or the Bayfield County UW Extension website.
Of course, it would also have it. Judith Mastami, you talked about the wonderful world of willow.
Ah, yes.
Can you explain that?
I'm an increasing fan of willow for whatever reason, both for winter interest. You can really get some beautiful stems, and if you don't have anything to do in the winter, you're sitting around the world of basketry and crafting and that kind of thing, and you can grow some really astounding willow plants. There's also something to play around with is willow sculpture, where you actually grow willow in these dense plantings, and then you can weave and twist and turn and train them, and you can make some pretty amazing structures. We're actually making a fort for the kids out of living willow.
Oh, you're kidding.
Training them together and crossing them. And so it's just a fun, fast-growing plant. Once it's established, you can't kill it. Plus, you can easily reproduce it. You just take stem cuttings, stick them in the ground, and they grow in the spring.
I hope you're taking some pictures of this, some photos. I'd love to see some of them. We can put them up on our Facebook page.
You bet.
That would be absolutely wonderful. I'm intrigued. It's fun, too, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So you're making a whole fort.
Yeah, that and using some hybrid poplar as well. And then we can work vines into it and something fun for the kids to learn about plants and be involved. They all like to make forts, so why not make forts out of living plants instead of sticks, right?
Yeah, then they probably last a little bit longer as well.
Yeah, right.
Well, I tell you what, this has been a real pleasure, Jason. I'm hoping that we have a chance to do this again in their last 30 seconds. Any final tip?
Remember to prune those tomatoes.
Ah.
Don't give up on them. If you want red ones, you got to keep the slugs and moisture off of them.
You know, I'm going to go home and do that. I'm going to try one of those Mr. Stripey's green, but I'm convinced they're not. I'm convinced they're supposed to be red and yellow and so forth. Jason, thank you so much.
Sure.
You'll do this again with us?
You bet.
Appreciate it very much. Jason Fishbach is a UW Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties, and he can answer a broad range of questions, can't he? Just taking a look ahead, Monday, Labor Day, Judith's going to be filling in for me. Thank you, Judith. And she's going to be doing a bird show with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. If you have a picture of a bird you'd like to have identified, post the picture on our Facebook page over the weekend so they can take a look. Thanks for listening.